Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous fireside room, the speaker is Chuck Huff, and he will be speaking on conflict, finding common ground. So let's listen in on Chuck Huff.
I'm a social psychologist, which means I study how people get along with each other, or don't, as the case may be, how perception and the way we think influences how we interact with each other. And what I've been doing this week is a series on conflict. And I've been putting everybody off until today because people have kept saying, well, how do you come to an agreement? And today what I'm going to do is to talk about some steps for creative problem solving. Now, none of these are answers. That is, none of these steps guarantee that your recalcitrant partner will do what you want them to. Sorry. But I think they will at least give you a better chance so that you can say to yourself that you did your best to try to come to an agreement. And when I say that, it assumes that the other side is motivated to talk to you. And we've talked before about why escalation at times might be a reasonable strategy to use in order to give the other party a wake-up call and say that you were really interested in negotiating and how to escalate while still being clear that you wanted a negotiated solution so that you could get them to the table. One of the things I'm not talking about here, but we can later if you're interested, is problems with getting from a highly escalated situation to problem solving. I mean, very often what happens is you've got two negotiating partners at loggerheads, and one of you wants to move to problem solving, but there's a whole lot of problems in doing that, because the other party may think you're a wimp. They say, she's given up. If you go to problem solving. But what I want to talk about now is just some methods for problem solving. And first, I'd like to show you some that I don't recommend, but that are sort of the standard ones that people are used to seeing. Ooh, there, that's better. Compromise is the kind of thing we always talk about as the solution to a situation where there's a conflict of interest between two parties. We call it the great American tradition. We have a lot of good things to say about compromise. The problem for me with compromise is that it really is too simple a thing, because you've already gone at loggerheads over issues that the two of you deeply care about. And then, if what you're going to get out of here, go. That was a fly. I promise it was. It's not that I've been out in the sun too long. Die. Excuse me. Conflict resolution right there. The problem is that if you've been at loggerheads and both of you care deeply about these two sides, what a compromise means is that both of you accept less than what you want. That is, both of you get less than an optimal solution. And when that happens, the agreement that you come to can be very unstable, because both parties are unhappy. They didn't get what they wanted. So there are some things over which the only answer is compromise. I'm not saying that you can't, that, you know, always avoid compromise, but compromise, usually what people do is they're exhausted after a conflict. They don't have very many resources to put towards problem solving, and they immediately say, all right, I'll meet you halfway. Sort of a kind of an out of breath manner. And what happens then is that both sides of the arrangement get less what they want than what they want, and you get an unstable agreement. Both parties are unhappy, and you may, in fact, have an eruption of disagreement later. Another problem, and my favorite lawyer can tell you about this, is coming to an agreement on a procedure for deciding who will win. Well, because if you come to an agreement on who's on a procedure for who's going to win, well, somebody wins and somebody loses. And a person who loses is usually not very happy, even if they think the procedure was fair. They don't get what they want. And there's all kinds of sort of time-honored traditions for having winners and losers. You know, voting, having a third party, having mama come in and solve it. Having resources go to the party who feels most strong about the issue, or for the party who says they have the most need. Flipping coins, straws. I didn't even put lawyers up, but no, I won't say that. But there's a whole lot of time-honored traditions for deciding on who will win. What you usually see in conflict resolution is that we go to one of these two things. We either compromise and we say, ooh, we've been smart, we compromised, instead of doing this. Well, this is probably worse than compromise, but I'd like to suggest to you that there are what I call integrative agreements that integrate the needs of both sides that are better than any of these.
Are you talking about a win-win situation?
Yes, sir. I really recommend this book. They're part of a negotiation project. They go into a great deal more detail about how to do these kinds of integrative agreements creatively. What I want to simply do right now is to describe what each of these ideas are, and to talk to you and to suggest to you the kind of information that you need in order to make a decision about whether you can do one of these or not. So expanding the pie is a relatively straightforward idea. That is, if the problem is the two companies are at a loading dock and they're fighting over who gets there first in the morning, one of the things that you can do, surprise, get a bigger loading dock, right? And they can both get there when they want. Now, the kind of thing that you need to do, the kind of information that you need to know about in order to look at expanding the pie is, what are the critical resources? That is, what are the resources that the parties need over which there's some conflict? And then you can look at those resources and say, is there some way we can get more of them? And if that's possible, then what you've got is an integrative agreement, right? It's win-win. Both parties get what they want because there's enough pie now for everybody. Non-specific compensation is a fancy word for paying them off. What you do when you pay them off is you find out what other things they need that are of value to them. When you may be fighting over a particular issue, but you may have information on the side that they need something else. This kind of thing happens in international agreements all the time. It is why the United States has an international aid budget, because we provide non-specific compensation by saying, we will give you so much in foreign aid if you'll sign this agreement. So if you have some idea about the other things that a party values in addition to the things that you're fighting over, it's possible that you can give them something that they need in order to get from them what you need. So they may be able to give up a little bit of it in order to get something else. And what this means, of course, is bringing another issue in. Now, sometimes that can get a little hairy because it makes things more complicated. Because now you've not got just one issue on the table, but two. Another thing that you can do is what's called log rolling. Log rolling is first requires you to know what the interests of the other party are and which ones are important to them and which ones are least important to them. And then for you to take your interests and find out which ones are important to you and which ones are least important to you. You may find out that the two of you rank your interests differently. If the two of you rank your interests differently, then what you can do is work out a way that you give up on things you don't care very much about, but they care a great deal about. They give up on things that they don't care very much about, but you care a great deal about. This requires, then, an analysis of their interests. This is a skill devoutly to be sought. It is the kind of skill that makes you a good negotiator, thinking carefully about other people's interests and about your own. Very often, when we're in the heat of a social conflict, we think everything is equally important. It's all mine. And what happens then is that you cut yourself off from the possibility of these kinds of solutions. If everything is equally important to you, well, then you've got nothing you can give up. All you can do is either win or lose. Cost cutting involves finding out what it is about the kind of agreement you'd like to have that costs the other person something. And then working out a way to lower that cost to them. It might be paying them something, and then it looks suspiciously like non-specific compensation, but who cares about, you know, how we divide these things up? What you really want to know is the reason some people may not want to come to an agreement with you is that it's too costly for them. So you want to find out, well, what is it that you want that is going to cost them? And then you work out a way to lower that cost for that other party. Now, one of the things that we can talk about is these are hard to do in the abstract. One of the things we can talk about is some specific situations and examples of these later. Bridging is sometimes the most difficult one to do, but it is often the kind of solution that really gets everybody what they want. What this requires, again, is an analysis not simply of the surface interests, but of the deeper interests of the two parties. I'll give you one example, because this is kind of a tough one to understand. In the 1973 war between Israel and Egypt, at the end of the stalemate, they were trying to work out a way to come to a ceasefire. Egypt had just lost a great deal of territory. Israel, surprise, was deeply concerned about its security. And the question became, how do we come to some agreement about security on the border? What Kissinger was able to work out is he discovered that the Egyptians were mostly interested in saving face, not necessarily in having territory. Who wants the Sinai anyway? Right? There's not a whole lot out there. But that the Israelis were mostly interested in security. And as they wanted to make sure that there was not a possibility of another attack. So they were able to arrange a setup so that it looked like the Egyptians had control of the road that went into the Gaza territory. But in fact, the Israelis had it surrounded with tanks and lots of weapons. So the people at the checkpoints were Egyptians, but they were surrounded by Israelis. Both parties got their underlying interest. If they had merely said, no, he went all the Sinai, neither of them would have been able to come to some kind of an agreement. But what they did is that they looked for underlying interests that parties had. And we talked about this some in earlier sessions, where we talked, for instance, about a church conflict that looks like it's over who has the key to the closet that has the toilet paper. And it may well be that that argument isn't really over toilet paper, but the argument is over who it is that gets to make decisions about where what is stored, or who it is that makes decisions about how the custodial staff does its job. And if you can look at the underlying interests, you can very often find a way to get both parties what they want. The problem is in trying to find out what those interests really are. And if you've been in a long, protracted sequence of escalation, it may be very difficult to find out what the other party really cares about. So at any rate, these are some kind of examples, and we can talk more specifically later about how they work. And I want to give you an idea of how to go about doing the kind of conflict creative problem solving that I'm talking about. This is a loop, so that you go down to here and you may end up going back to one, right? You may have to go back and reanalyze interests and reanalyze your aspirations. One of the things you want to do is to start with the question, is there really a conflict of interest here? And of course, that requires looking not simply at what the initial claims are of people, and it's very easy for us to get focused on those when we're upset. It's very easy to think that the argument is over the toilet paper when in fact it's not. The toilet paper is just a stand-in for a much deeper issue. And you may find, after an analysis of interests, that in fact there is not a conflict of interest, and you can quickly come to some kind of a solution. Number two is a thing that many people forget to do, and that is set reasonably high goals and be ready to stick to them. This, in fact, is where lawyers come in some arguments in a pretty handy way, because they can serve as a messenger to the other party and say, they'll take no less than this. Here's what they really need. What I like to call this second step sounds a bit like an oxymoron, like a contradiction. I like to call it firm flexibility. and it's not an oxymoron, because you're being firm about one thing and flexible about another. You're being firm about your basic interests. And you communicate to the other party that you are willing to escalate in order to get what you think your basic interests are. Remember, you've already analyzed to figure out what your basic interests are, and you're no longer talking just about the toilet paper. What you are, though, is flexible about the way you get it. You are, and you communicate to the other party your willingness to engage in problem solving. You communicate to the other party your care for them getting the outcome that they want, so that you are at the same time firm about your needs and flexible about the way you get them. Very often it's hard for us to separate these two, because it makes it easier to be firm if we just say, I want it, right? Because we can focus our mind that way. The problem, of course, is that if the other side is doing that, then you just shout at each other. But firm flexibility, if you can pull it off, allows you to convince the other party that you care deeply and that they really ought to negotiate with you. Because if they don't, you might go back into escalation. But that you are very willing to work with them. Then, surprise, work with them is step number three. Seek a way to get both parties' interests reconciled. One of the things you may find is that at least the way it works now, at least the way your conversation went, you're not able to come to an agreement. Well, you lower somebody's aspirations, either yours or theirs. It's easy to lower your aspirations. It's a little harder to lower theirs. Of course, one way to lower their aspirations is to go back into escalation and to say, I'm not giving up. You really need to back down some. Or you can reanalyze interest. It may be that the reason you couldn't come to a solution is because you hadn't thought deep enough about what it was we agreed on. The whole thing that got me started on doing this conflict series this week was Christine Carlson's Bible study on Romans, where she pointed out that what Paul was really doing, and Everett has been doing this week too, what Paul is really doing is talking about a conflict between two different sides in Romans and saying, but wait a minute, you have got together some very basic interests that you ought to be able to agree on, which is that you are members of the body of Christ and that you are all justified by Jesus Christ. And if you go low enough in this hierarchy of interests, you will find very often that you'll come to a place where the two of you agree. It may still not solve your problem, but it might make you feel better that they're not simply them, those horrible people. And then, of course, step five is it won't always work. Sometimes you're in a situation where the other party simply is not going to be interested in coming to some kind of an agreement with you. And at this point, you have to decide if what you want to do is to escalate some more in order to wake them up, or withdraw, get out of it. This is why I said I don't have easy answers. I have very easy answers for how to sort letters of the alphabet on a computer, you know, because I can come up with an algorithm that does that, and it's just you and me and a couple of rules in order to get that to work. The problem here is that we got another person. And I can't make any guarantees about what that other person's opinions are or willingness to negotiate is. One of the things I want to suggest, and I'm sort of towards the end of this abstract discussion, one of the things I want to suggest is that you need to get involved in this kind of a process very carefully, because it's very possible to inadvertently signal to the other party that you're willing to give them what they want and you don't care a great deal about your interests. Because after all, what are they focused on? They're focused on their interests. They're not thinking about yours. And this is a delicate balancing act. This is why, if you've been having a knockdown, drag-out fight, it is difficult to attempt to move immediately into problem solving, because they may say, oh, he's given in, and now I can get what I want. So these kinds of ways of coming to agreement, in that allows all the parties to be happy, are worth trying before you back into compromise or you back into going to the lawyers and having them get a judge decide. Because very often you can come up with an agreement that both parties are willing to live with and that both parties, in fact, are happy about. If you can get an integrative agreement, it strengthens your relationship with the other party. It makes them glad to talk to you again. And it, in fact, makes it more likely that you're going to get another integrative agreement later if a conflict of interest comes up. It also spreads in the community. Because people can say, oh, well, I see that happened with them. Perhaps we can work something out. So often in our churches and volunteer organizations, we decide that it's either my way or the highway, as I remember an old saying. And what that produces is an inability to come to an agreement that both sides will be happy with. And those agreements exist out there. What they require is your ability to analyze the interests of both parties and the kinds of resources that are needed to come to a solution. I say all this in a very abstract way, partly because you can't get much more concrete without jumping right to examples. If you're interested in these lists, I'll be glad to give you my copies. But what I really recommend that you do is go back, is get that book, Getting to Yes, or get this book, The Social Conflict. This is where I've been stealing all my ideas from. And I feel it's safe now since I give them credit. One of the reasons I like this, in addition to the Getting to Yes book, is the Getting to Yes book is primarily about coming up with some kind of a negotiated agreement. And this book is about what you might want to do if you can't. Which is some of the other stuff we've been talking about, like escalation. So, this is by Jeffrey Rubin, Dean Pruitt, and Sung-hee Kim. But you can come up and copy the pages first. So having done that, I'm done with my spiel. I left my watch in the shower. What time is it?
6:40.
So that means we've got 20 minutes or so. Questions, thoughts, exclamations that this will never work?
We've talked quite a bit about anger this week.
Yes, sir.
And I guess one of the thoughts in my mind is, are there things that should be done before we move into creative problem solving if the other party is really angry? And I'm thinking of the other party is so angry at me that it's very difficult. It's almost difficult for them to even sit down and talk to me.
That's right. You are evil incarnate.
Right.
That's on the tape now, by the way.
Well, my wife might agree with you.
One of the problems after you've had a big fight and they think that you're a horrible person is to get them to trust you when you're coming to them with a negotiated agreement. Because you say, well, I've analyzed our interests and I think that we might want to do this and you can do the other thing and we will, look at our lower interests and I think that if I provide you with this, we allocate this and we'll be all right. And they'll go, I believe you. One of the suggestions that's been made, and it's been tested out in both in studies and a lot of practical negotiations, is the giving of concessions unilaterally. Now, you have to be careful when you do this. But if you can, after a big fight, and you're trying to get the other person to believe that you're on their side, if you can unilaterally offer some concession, then that often is another kind of wake-up call for the other side. Now, there's a couple of things you have to be careful about when you offer these concessions. One, you don't want to give away the store. You don't want to give away so much so that if they decide simply to take the money and run, that you're left in the lurch. But you do want to give away enough so that the other party realizes that you have given away a thing of value. Another thing that you might want to do is to publicly make your announcement that you're going to give this thing away ahead of time, and then do it later. This indicates some trustworthiness on your part. You might also say, even, I'm going to offer a series of unilateral concessions. First, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do that, then I'm going to do the other thing. All this is for you, free. And if you can, and if you have this kind of stuff to give to the other party without harming your own basic interests too much, a series of announced gifts that are publicly announced and followed up on are very hard to misunderstand. A series is very hard to misunderstand. Sorry about that. So part of what we're dealing, remember we were talking earlier during escalation about the kinds of misperceptions you easily get wrapped up into. And so what you have to do in order to undo those misperceptions and undo the other party's willingness to think the worst of you is to make it very hard for them to do that. And sometimes these sort of gradual, unilateral concessions can do that. And at the same time, you don't want to say simply, and this is just because I'm a nice guy. You want to say, I'm doing this because I want you to know that you can trust me. And I'd like to engage in a dialogue with you.
about how we can come to some kind of a negotiated settlement. Yeah.
I don't know what you mean by gifts. Would it be possible to take a hypothetical situation?
Got one?
No.
Well, let me give you an example from international conflict. One of the things that Russia did right after the sort of perestroika movement is they began to move some of their weapons and armor away from the front in Europe. And they said ahead of time that they were going to do it. And then they did it. And they did that in an attempt to get the United States and NATO to understand that they really were trying to be conciliatory, partly because they desperately needed money. In that particular example, although they followed all the rules that I was just suggesting, there were still people in the United States who didn't trust them as far as they could spit. Because we had such a long history of conflict. So again, these don't always work, but sometimes it's the best thing that you can do. Yes?
What is your experience with, and what do you think of allowing, if the other party is furious at you still? That's interesting, because I find that too to be one of the big blocks, is how do you get past that moment of being so furious you can't.
Right.
Talk civilly to each other. What do you think of the idea or the experience of letting the other party just vent? You know, if you can keep your own emotions under control enough not to hit back for once. You find that that's a useful... Yeah, you're right. Do you find it's a useful exercise or not?
It's a dangerous exercise. Because what happens when people... I really recommend the book that I asked the bookstore to buy and that they have called Anger. Mm-hmm. It's by Carol Chavers. It's an excellent review of what we know about the emotion of anger. And it helps a lot to understand these kinds of things in negotiation. One of the problems with venting is that sometimes venting is simply rehearsing all of the evils you have done unto me. Mm-hmm. So it may not reduce my anger. It may simply make me angrier. Now, I'm not saying that it doesn't work. Sometimes, in fact, venting does work. But it has to be done very carefully. I usually don't like to see venting happen unless you have a third party. And I would rather see, if you have two people fighting who hate each other, I'd rather have a mediator come in and have the person vent to the mediator. Mm-hmm. Because then you don't have the problem of them venting to the other person, and you know, who's in the conflict, and then maybe having it blow up, which is precisely the danger you were talking about with people being ready to retaliate. Mm-hmm. So venting can be useful, but I think it's more safely done with a third party than it is with the other person in. Because it's very hard to just sit there and take it and then be nice. Ministers know how to do that, right, Maury? There's a class on that in seminary.
In your first year in the church.
Yes. Was that enough of an answer?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a little.
She wanted a little more, and then.
Yeah, I'm a little suspicious of venting simply because I'm afraid that it might get us back into this escalation sequence.
More afraid of what of the not being productive for the person who's venting, or hooking the person who's listening.
Hooking the person
who's listening. Okay.
Yeah. And they might also find that it's fun to vent against them, too. So
yeah. There is a thrill.
Yeah, you're going, ooh, watch them cringe. Let's do that again. Oh, there's that on, I haven't seen the Disney movie out now. Where the coyotes are going, ooh, say it again.
I wonder if you're giving listening to venting a bad rap. I suspect the distinction is, if it's a highly charged emotional situation, listening to somebody vent could create other problems. But I'm thinking of conflicts where it's a little milder conflict than sitting around a table, perhaps. And I learned this from a pastor friend of mine, and we'd go to meetings and sort of the other side would propose things that I wanted to simply go over there and wring their neck about. And he...
And you're big, started. Too. And you're big, too.
Well, thank you. But he would sit there and take it and listen. And I'd whisper in his ear, he was my senior, and I would say, you know, go shoot them. No, wait. And surprisingly, in many of these meetings, now 9 times out of 10, let's say, they would have what they wanted out.
Right.
And then he would later quietly suggest his alternatives, and 9 times out of 10, it went his way. And what he said to me was very helpful. He said, sometimes people need to ventilate, and we need to let them do that. And after they get it all out, it comes around to something more reasonable.
Yeah, but I'd suggest not using the ventilate language, partly because I'm leery of the whole psychology that underlies, you know, there's this bubbling anger in me that has to get out. Mm-hmm. But it is true that people need to have their say and to feel like they've been listened to. And that may be different from venting.
Okay.
Does, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, the thing I was reacting to, partly in your language, was this language of venting, which suggests this whole psychology of what anger is that I disagree with. Because I think anger is a thing that sometimes if you sit on it, it will go away. And in fact, there's a lot of research that suggests that anger, if you sit on it, will go away. Not all anger, but some. And the problem is we've got such a popular conception. I mean, we're sort of taken over by the Freudians in our society. So that we think that any little bit of anger we've got in us, we've got to get out now. And this makes for very intolerant people who are willing to jump down your throat for their own health. And so that they won't have a heart attack. You will. And so I think that there are times, in fact, when it's useful to ventilate, but I'm afraid of doing it just to get out the anger. I would rather see it happen in a situation where the other person feels like you really care about the things that they're saying. And in fact, what I recommend when that kind of thing happens is not simply taking it, but telling them what you've heard. So that they say, I think, you know, and they talk about your ancestry and their ancestry, et cetera. And sometimes they get all of this out, but you did hear the thing about the toilet paper,
yeah.
Right? And you say, well, what I understand is that you're very angry about the toilet paper. And I can see that. And why is it? I mean, what's going on here? And then you can talk about that issue instead of just, you know, letting them get their anger out. Because if you just let them get their anger out and sit there like a stone, and they don't think you've heard them, they may just get madder.
Yeah, just the point about ventilation. I've done quite a lot of negotiating at university, between student groups, between parent groups, between various groups, and the danger with letting the outside ventilate is that they get carried away. And they have this build-up, and it's it's a snowball effect, and it gets, you know, the whole room becomes very intense. And then when they calm down, they're sitting there panting, and they're embarrassed by it. You know, they feel they feel open-minded, they don't feel like they can negotiate any further. And I think that's dangerous. You know, they feel
that's right.
They've done everything they can. They've got this far, and then they've and it's all over. It's like a climax. And they're like, what happens then? And I think in that role, it's very, very dangerous because it only takes one word, and it's all sparked.
And then boom.
Yeah,
that's right. Because they pour gasoline on the floor.
Yeah.
And all you have to do is throw in a match.
Exactly.
And that's what I meant. And you said it much better than I did. Mm-hmm. That's what I meant by rehearsing.
Okay.
Because very often what happens when another person, when you have someone ventilate their anger, is they get on this roll. And they say, and you've done this, and you've done this, and you've done that, and you've done the other thing. And you don't care about me. And your mother's ugly, you know, and they get on this roll. And so you've got this long, long list of complaints. Remember the ones we were talking about the last time we met, where you bring more and more people into the conflict, and you bring larger issues in, so it's no longer about the toilet paper, it's about the fact that you're an ungrateful wife. And, you know, so when you get on a roll like this, like you were talking about, It can, in fact, make it worse. So when in good, with good intentions, we let people vent, we may do more damage. So I suggest that if you're going to do it, you try to do it in a very controlled situation.
Then how do you stop this sudden outburst of venting if you all of a sudden realize you're into an unhealthy venting situation? It's often one of the mosquito model.
You just slap them. No, that probably won't help. What I have done when I have seen that, I try not to get into it. And so I try to do it when I'm acting as a third party, just with me and that person. And even when they get on a roll like that, I'll say, now, wait a minute, time out. What did you just say? And if you can then, and what they may at that point realize is that they have gotten on a roll like this. And keep dragging people back to their basic interests. That's why this interest analysis is so important. Because what happens is in an escalative conflict that's in escalation, the interests become global. I mean, we're no longer interested just in South Vietnam as a viable country, but we're interested in stopping communism all over the world. And then, of course, that's hard to negotiate. So what I do is attempt to interrupt people and, you know, sort of stop them and say, wait a minute, what have you just said? Now this is, and I'm saying this as a third party mediator rather than as the other party. It's a lot harder to do when you try to interrupt the person and it's just the two of you, because then they just get angrier.
You evil incarnate are telling me is not.
That's right. He'll tell me to be quiet.
So what do you do with the other party?
What do you do in that two-person situation? Run.
That's really good.
Technique is to go to the bathroom.
That's right. Yeah. Excuse me, I've got to go to the bathroom. Yeah.
You can you say know, that you're clergy, you can say I was praying.
Well, you can go to the bathroom and pray.
That's right. Yeah. Or you can say time out.
Right.
This is in a diplomatic way.
That's right.
Let us back off and then come at it again.
Yeah, but you've got to kind of break that role that they're on where they're rehearsing all of these evils. And of course, since we never do that ourselves, we don't have to worry about somebody interrupting us. those are very good questions, and you often see conflict break down and people never getting to negotiated solutions simply because they get so worn out with this kind of shouting and yelling, that they end up with compromise or some other less useful solution. And you have to stop that and get people, drag people back to their basic interests. And you do that simply with a series of questions. You know, they say, well, what is it you want? And you say, why is that important? Well, you play three-year-old, right? You go, why? 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 And as you do all those whys, you get to deeper and deeper and deeper interests. At some point, of course, you lose them. And they get upset with you. But it's important to drag people back to their basic interests so, in fact, they can get what they want instead of getting what they think they want.
I teach elementary school, and I find it very helpful in dealing with children to give them a piece of paper and a pencil and say, write this down for me.
That's a good idea.
Especially when children are having a conflict. It really works out well. And many times they vent a great deal on that paper.
Right.
But no one else ever sees it, so they
right.
get an embarrassment.
Right.
That's a great thing.
Yeah, I like that. And there's a variety of things like that where people suggest you write a letter to the person. And then you sit on it for a couple of days, and then you read it again in order to see, you know, and usually you feel pretty silly at that point.
Isaac Asimov had this technique of writing an angry letter to a person who irritated him, and knowing that he wasn't really going to mail it, tear it up. But he said it didn't work unless he actually put the letter in an envelope, addressed the envelope, and even put a stamp on it first.
Mm.
And then tore it up.
Most office is promoting that program.
First class.
What time is it again? Since I don't have my watch.
It is 7.
It is time.
13.
All right. Well, thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun. And tomorrow morning we're going to talk before I hop on the bus. We're going to talk some about third-party mediation. That's what the 18th Camel is. It's a kind of cute title, but it's really about third-party negotiation. Bye.